Welcome to the Fresh Heart Project. My name is Zareen, I'm a cardiologist and your host. Today, I am delighted to introduce Natalie Larkin. We discuss her journey with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, or EDS, an inherited condition that makes the connective tissue in her body weaker and leaves her with chronic pain. Ehlers-Danlos syndrome is under-recognised, and that's why Natalie is passionate about raising awareness so that people feel seen and represented. Natalie is an entrepreneur, an advocate for sustainability in business, and a mum to three children. Whilst homeschooling during the first lockdown, she noticed that with the addition of plants to her house, her husband's asthma improved. As she has a degree in psychology, she became fascinated with the intersection of plants, productivity, and health. So much so that she set up an online business selling plants. Before we discuss Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, Natalie shares why she decided to start her business.
I'd read this thing about how plants increase productivity, and I was sort of delving into it, and it just really got me, and it just made a lot of sense. Obviously, like, plants give out off oxygen, and oxygen helps your brain to work and makes you think more clearly, and in turn makes you more creative, makes you more productive. And like, there's been all sorts of studies that have shown that there are actually marked improvements in people's productivity in areas where they have plants compared to areas where they don't. And I just thought to myself, this is something that people could do with and people don't know enough about. So my husband found a wholesaler for plants and we bought a few, and I just started pushing it as, like, to my friends, as this might be what your house is needing. It's hard to get in that zone. I mean, a lot of people, when they get home from work, they get through the door and that's your home life started. That's not where your workspace is. I mean, my husband's got an office at home, but it's not, it just doesn't have the same vibe. And he noticed that having plants in his room was making a massive difference to him. And even he's got quite bad asthma, and having plants in our bedroom was helping him sleep better. So if you're sleeping better, you're working better because you're more rested. So it was all just this knock-on effect. I just wanted to do it in a nice way for people and get the plants that had the most benefits, and like NASA recommended plants that they have on the space station and things, and just anything just to sort of help people keep positive, keep productive, keep creative whilst being stuck in your home and not really feeling like it.
Yeah, amazing. And, you know, you did mention that plants have a lot of health benefits. Yeah. And your husband noted the health benefits. Has everyone else in your family noted those health benefits as well?
Massively. I mean, yeah, we've got an insane amount of plants in our house. Yeah. But I think our oxygen levels must be pretty high. But yeah, the kids sleep better. I mean, even my eldest daughter, who really struggled, like, you'd see her still on her phone like at midnight and be like, come on, Lola, go to bed. But she's got plants in her room now, and she feels rested, and she wakes up in the morning ready to go, and they're not sluggish. And I think, yeah, they've made a massive difference to all of us.
Yeah. And, you know, the achievement of setting up a business within the pandemic, if that isn't enough, it is all the more remarkable because you have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome.
Yeah.
Now, can you just tell us a little bit about a sort of brief summary of Ehlers-Danlos syndrome and what it is?
Sure. So Ehlers-Danlos syndrome is a connective tissue disorder that affects joints and skin elasticity. Effectively, at its root, it is a collagen defect. So I'm not able to produce more collagen as normal bodies would replicate their collagen. And the collagen I have is faulty. So it's kind of the glue that holds everything together, but it's like old glue. So it tears, and collagen, literally there's like 12 things that your body has to do to keep you alive, and it needs collagen for all of them. So it literally affects everything from my ability to grow my hair to my heart to my legs and my joints, bruising, scarring, everything, because everything requires collagen. So that's basically what it is. So it doesn't affect everyone in the same way. Everybody, there's lots of different types of Ehlers-Danlos as well. So obviously that affects different parts of the body, or have more likelihood of affecting different parts of the body. But yeah, so fundamentally it affects everything.
And it's an inherited condition, isn't it?
It is, yeah. So it travels on alleles like sickle cell anemia. So if you've got two parents who are carriers, they normally say the first child shouldn't be affected. A second child would be a carrier. A third child would be a carrier. And a fourth child would be most affected. And I am the fourth child.
And when we were emailing back and forth before this interview, you Split, you mentioned your biggest challenges, and one of those challenges is that the pain that you live with. And knowing you, we've known each other for a few years. Kids go to the same school, and so I've seen you at school pickup. Mm-hmm. I would have absolutely no idea about the pain that you would live with. You
master of deception.
Yeah. Absolutely no idea. And so for me, it was actually quite a surprise to read that it does affect you on a daily basis. So yeah. Can you talk to us about the effects that that pain has on your life?
The thing with pain, obviously pain is subjective and everybody experiences pain in a different way. If I gave my pain to you, you might say it was a 3 and someone else might say it was a 10. Yeah. But pain is draining.
Yeah.
Pain is wearing, and it just gets you. And I wake up in the morning and I'm in pain. Sleep isn't a restful thing for me. Sleep is just as painful as if I had walked a marathon. So it's just, I mean, because I was diagnosed very young. I was diagnosed at 18 months, which now is not even possible. They won't diagnose a child till they're 5 now. But I've always known that this was part and parcel of being me. So it's not like I had an injury or an illness and then I was left feeling this way. I think that's probably the only reason that I'm able to cope. I think if I knew what it was like to be well, it would probably be harder on a day-to-day basis. But I've been given things in the past like acupuncture that help with the pain, but in a way they're not helpful, because you go through this period of maybe 3 months of not having so much pain. And then when the pain comes back, it's the same as it was before, but it feels worse because you know what it's like to feel better.
Yeah.
And pain is just draining.
Yeah.
Like a heavy coat that you wear.
Yeah.
And you just, yeah, some days you're better at carrying it than others.
And there are certain experiences that kind of, certainly when you told me about them, sort of stuck in my mind. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened in childbirth?
Yeah, so I've got 3 children. They were all natural deliveries, and they were all 3 completely different births. I knew beforehand, I read a lot of information from the EDS support groups, Fragile Links and people like that, about what things could go wrong. And I suppose you'd say I'm a pessimist. I like to prepare for the worst. If you expect the worst, then the best is amazing, isn't it? So if you assume it's going to be bad, then if it's not, you don't feel so bad. And if it is bad, then you are prepared. So I went in armed and knowing that like postpartum hemorrhage was a big risk, and I knew all of those things were a possibility. And when I went into labour and my first daughter, obviously I didn't know what was going on. I didn't have any sort of background knowledge for it. It was okay, but I did have a massive postpartum hemorrhage. I did have a tear. When they did the tear, I said to her, you're going to need to give me a lot of anaesthetic. I think that's one of the hardest things for doctors to hear. Can I have more anaesthetic? Because it just sounds like a ruse, doesn't it? Like, come on, numb me up. But because of my EDS, we have a very, very high tolerance for anaesthetic and analgesia as well. She'd given me 1 local anaesthetic injection and started doing all sorts of stitching and things, and it was agony. And I said, you're really hurting me. And she was like, it's not pain, it's just pressure. And I said, it's my body. I know when I'm in pain or when I'm just feeling pressure. And she wouldn't believe me. She did the whole thing with one stab of anaesthetic, and it was awful. And I was screaming almost. I kicked her at one point, I think, as well. And it's just that trying to not sound like a hysterical first time mum, and try and get someone to help you because you know what's best for you. And I'm sure doctors and nurses have to tolerate that all day long from people who do know and people that don't know and people that are trying it on. And you can appreciate it, but it doesn't make it any easier. So Lola's birth was fun, but not horrendous. When I had my second daughter, I'd seen the consultant all the way up to my labour. Made really extensive notes, really concise, everything was there for them. They knew everything they needed to know. But when you rock up at midnight and it's just one girl there who doesn't know you, who hasn't seen you, hasn't read your notes. I mean, she said to me afterwards, I mean, I said everything was in my notes. And she said, well, if we had time to read everyone's notes, we wouldn't do much else. And you think, well, what was the point of me spending 9 months writing the notes for you then? but my second birth was awful. She didn't believe me when I said that I would I dilated more than she thought I had, because she thought there wasn't enough time for that to have happened, even though it had. I lost a massive amount of blood. They couldn't find Sophia's heartbeat. That was traumatic. I was almost unconscious because of the blood loss. And I can only remember my husband saying, that the nurses saying, we can't find her heartbeat. And my husband saying, if she's gone, can you still save Nat? And I don't remember anything after that. And then I was in surgery for 7 hours after that. I had a spinal block that she said it would last 12 hours, that only lasted two, again, because of my EDS. But fortunately, she took pity on me and gave me lots and lots of local. I think she had to re-administer local about seven times. It was a horrible experience. I mean, I'm not entirely sure why I went on to have a third child after that. So I suppose I felt like they kind of needed an opportunity to redeem themselves. And my third one was the best, but my third one was induced, and it was a lot more structured, a lot more controlled. The nurses knew me. I did the whole day there before to explain what was going on and what they needed. And by that time, I just wasn't prepared to take any nonsense from anybody. And I knew exactly what I was and wasn't going to let them do. Yeah. And I think sometimes when you're in hospital, you feel a bit helpless and you're sort of at their mercy. They're there to help you, aren't they? And they're there to do what they're best for you. And sometimes someone like me, with a pretty extensive knowledge of their own medical history, might know better.
And goodness, I'm so sorry you went through that firstly. It sounds horrendous. Yeah. Has this taught you or forced you in a way to really learn to advocate for yourself? Is that something that you've had to do along
Absolutely.
The way?
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think it's something that people shouldn't be scared to do. I mean, you go to a doctor is vastly more knowledgeable than you about whatever you go to them for, because that's why you're going to them. You're going to them for information. But sometimes it's important that people are able to explain to the doctor exactly how they're feeling and not feel like the doctors are diminishing anything that they're feeling, because sometimes it's something in the nuance of the way that you tell a pain that makes a doctor think it's something different, and it changes the approach to your care entirely. And it's taken, I mean, I'm 32 and I think I've been seeing doctors my entire life, and it's taken me until now to feel comfortable saying to a doctor, I'm not happy with that, or no, we're not doing that, or no, you're not going to get blood out of that vein. and it is just sort of self-preservation. Yeah. But I'm happy to do that now, because I don't want to be black and blue from one blood test.
Yeah, absolutely. And how important was having, you know, your family that are really supportive around you growing up?
My mum is like a bulldog when it comes to our health. Yeah. And things. She, with the school, she would be banging down the door first thing on a Monday morning to tell them what they needed to do. And if I had to have special shoes or special dispensations for exams and things, I had a scribe and extra time and all sorts of things. And it was, at the time, it's a bit like, come on, mum, just leave me alone, I'm okay. And looking back now, I'm so glad that she did. And I know that I will be exactly the same for my children, because you need someone on your side, an advocate that knows you, that knows exactly what you're feeling, and is willing to stand up for you as well. Yeah. I mean, when I had my second labour, my husband was so in shock that he didn't have a chance to tell anybody. And I think he's always felt a bit guilty about that he should have been like, look at her notes, just look at her notes. But yeah, my family have been amazing. And when we moved, my parents moved just after us as well, so they live nearby, so they can help. And my mum's always all, do you want me to get the kids from school? How are you today? And if I have to go for a blood test, oh, I'll come with you just in case. And because she knows in the past I've had blood tests and they've been awful, or the people have bust a vein and I've passed out. So yeah. She's always super on it.
Oh, that is wonderful. I'm really pleased that you got that family support around you. And when you spoke to me about your challenges, the first challenge was pain that we mentioned, and this the second challenge made me really sad, and that is the guilt that comes with EDS. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's like you said, like, you see me at the school gates and you wouldn't know that there was anything wrong, and that's how I like to be. I don't like to have to ask for help. I don't like to have to feel like I'm a burden. I think that's the best way to put it. When I had my children, I never had children to have live-in carers. And when I got married, I didn't get married to have a live-in carer. And I've, over the years, when things have happened, I have felt like there's things that my husband has to do for me that other husbands don't have to do for their wives. And that does make me feel guilty. And it makes me feel guilty that my children know if I'm having a bad day or a good day, and you just want to be a consistent mum, and with a condition like Ehlers-Danlos, you can't always be consistent because every day you just don't know. And it does, yeah, the guilt is awful, and the guilt that I've now passed it on to my children as well, which was inevitable, really. But it doesn't make it any easier to know that they're experiencing the same things that I am. And now I have the added joy of each of them having different aspects of EDS and having to know one thing for one child, one thing for another child. And now my son's only three, so he's not even been diagnosed yet, although I'm sure he probably has aspects of EDS as well. Mm-hmm. And knowing what I know, I can look at him and I'll go, oh, blue scalera, or oh, velvety skin. And mm-hmm. and I know these things. And yeah, it does make me feel bad.
Yeah. Goodness, I'm really sorry. And how much of it is made even more difficult, because a lot of it is invisible, because as I was mentioning earlier, meeting you at the school gates, I wouldn't know what you're going through. How much of it is made harder by it being a hidden, invisible issue or illness?
It makes it really difficult. It's if you leave a party early and people think, oh, she's not being very friendly, and it's not that I'm not being sociable, it's that I'm exhausted and I just need to go. It's the invisible illness kind of aspect of it that makes it, you almost feel like people don't believe you, that you get out of a card with your disabled badge and you can feel people's eyes on you, or sometimes you even get comments from people and you just think, it depends on what sort of day I'm having. If I'm having a high pain day, I'm probably just going to leave and cry. And if I'm having a low pain day, I'm probably going to tell them where to go. But you can't, there's no right way to come off in that situation. I mean, if you walk away, you look guilty, like you're doing something wrong. And if you have a go, then you're looking like you're being defensive because you're doing something wrong. We're in 2021 now, and people need to start appreciating that illnesses don't always look like a prosthetic leg or a wheelchair or crutches. I've needed crutches in the past and I can't use them because my legs aren't the only problem, because my shoulders are the problem too. So if I got out of my car with crutches, does that make it more acceptable? And people say, my in-laws or friends and people have said, oh, get out of the car and walk with a limp so people don't give you a funny look. And I said, well, I don't have to walk with a limp because I've had my badge since I was 13. And that's, they're renewed every 3 years, but that's plenty of times that they've renewed it. If the government or the council didn't think that I deserved it, they wouldn't keep renewing my badge. But it's sad, and it's sad to know that my children will have that as well.
And I guess that's why it's so important to raise awareness, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So that we know, and that we don't assume.
No, EDS is such a spectrum. I think everybody would fall on the spectrum at some place, even if it was really, really mild. And I think pain's the massive deciding factor. If you go to the doctor if there's an issue. You don't go to the doctor because you can bend your thumbs back or things. Like, you just wouldn't go if you were hypermobile. It's not the same for everyone. And I'm sure there's plenty of people like me that stay indoors and don't go and do things because it's easier to just not put yourself out there.
Yeah.
And I mean, in that way, it's the same as if I had a massive scar or mole across the whole of my face, and it was very obvious to people. Yeah. Those sorts of people with those illnesses, they don't want to go out and be seen. Equally, I don't want to go out and be seen because I don't look like I deserve to be a disabled person. It doesn't really make any sense, but it's hard.
Yeah.
Being a disabled person that doesn't look like a disabled person, no matter what. And that in itself is the problem, isn't it? What does a disabled person look like?
Exactly. And how important is having compassion for yourself?
I assume it's very important. It's very hard to have. It's one of those things everyone always says, you've got to be kind, and you've got to be kind to yourself. And I say it to other people as well. And it's the easiest thing to say and the hardest thing to do when your mind is willing and the body is weak, and you want to get up and do things and you just can't, and you feel like you're letting people down or dragging people back, or it's no fun.
But you do mention some wins, and for you they're the small wins, aren't they? Can you tell us about the small wins?
I think every day that I'm able to just get up and not snap at one of them for not being able to find the left shoe is a win. I had a car crash a few years ago and my shoulder was quite badly damaged and I still can't really use it. So even getting up in the morning and being able to put my own bra on is a win. I went for my yearly echo the other day and I have to take the top part of your clothes and put your gown on. And I was getting dressed afterwards and my shoulder had gone. And I was like, oh my God, I'm going to have to ask this sonographer to do my bra on for me. So it's, yeah, lots of fun things like that. But it's the little wins that actually mean more than the big wins. Mm. So if we've told the children in the holidays, oh, we're going to go to Chessington today, and I wake up and I feel okay, that's a win. Like I can actually do what I said I was going to do today. We don't tend to make a lot of plans because we sort of have to take one day at a time, take it as it comes. But it's nice when you're able to make a plan and follow through.
And with regards to wins, there was a spoon analogy that you used. Can you tell us about the spoon analogy?
I can't even remember where I came across this. I think it might actually be an ME thing. But basically, it's the spoon theory. I don't even know why they use spoons. It's so unnecessarily spoons. But they say that you start the day with a certain number of spoons, whatever, 10 spoons. And things like washing your hair would be a spoon, or cooking the dinner would be a spoon, or going to the shops would be a spoon. So you have to divvy up your spoons appropriately. So if you know that you're going out tomorrow, you know you've got to wash your hair tonight. So that's one spoon. So that means it looks like we're getting a takeaway, because I'm not doing the cooking and doing my hair and doing the school run and walking the dog and doing everything else. So yeah, it's and I hope I don't say it out loud. I know I think it a lot of the time. I'm like, too many spoons. If someone says to me, hey, do you want to go and get a drink later? I'm like, no, I washed my hair this morning.
Have you ever said too many spoons?
I hope I haven't said it out loud. I think that people probably just think I'm just having a bit of a weird one, but
I love that analogy and I'm going to use it for myself. I think it's brilliant.
It makes a lot of sense if you know what it's about. If you just say too many spoons and nobody knows what you're talking about, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. But yeah, I mean, like I said, it could be anything. It's too many eggs, too many lives if you're a gamer. It's anything like that.
Yeah, and I think looking at your, you know, achievements, for me, you have had massive wins. You're a mum of three. During lockdown, whilst homeschooling, you built a business. And it's not just it's an amazing, ethical, sustainable
business. To be honest,
business.
If it wasn't for the lockdown, I don't think I would have had the spoons to actually do the business, to set it up and do the things that were needed at the start. Because if I was having to do the school run every morning, I'm not coming home and wanting to sit on my computer for hours and set everything up and find suppliers and work out measurements for boxes and do all the admin and all of the social media and everything that comes with it. It just wouldn't have been feasible. No. So the fact that we had the lockdown, I mean, I feel really guilty when I say it, but the lockdown was actually amazing for us. Like, it just, for someone like me to have the opportunity to just say, I don't have to go anywhere. I don't have to get in the car. I mean, getting in and out of the car is hard enough. I mean, turning over in bed is hard enough. It's things that you don't even think about. I mean, I won't do the stairs in my house more than twice a day. I come down the stairs in the morning and I go up the stairs at night and that's it. So if there's anything upstairs that is needed, there's a spoon. It's another spoon. So the lockdown was amazing because it gave me an excuse to be antisocial and focus on the things that I needed to do that I would never have time for and never have the energy for or the spoons for.
And I mean, we're Facebook friends and I look at your Facebook posts and I laugh out loud. Honestly, they're hilarious. There was one particular post where it was actually depicting EDS and it was this little, I think it was a kitten, that was really struggling to hold together a bit of bone and a bit of socket. And the idea was the kitten was depicting your collagen.
Yeah, I use humour a lot. I think those memes and things, I post a lot of those memes. It's my roundabout way of letting everybody know that I'm not okay without burdening them with a big medical description of what it is that I'm going through. At least if I put a little meme and it says like having a bad day and it explains it in a way that's humorous, I feel like that's the way of me saying to people, look, I'm not leaving your party early because I'm rude. I'm leaving your party early because I've been here for an hour and that's really good for me. And I did my best. Like, I always try and do my best. And I've learned over the years when I would do more than my best and it would put me back. Then the next day I'm doing nothing because there's one spoon for the whole day. That you just, you have to do as much as you can. And after that, you can't do any more. And it's not just that you can't do any more, it's that you shouldn't do any more.
Natalie, looking back over your life, if you could give your younger self any advice from where you are now, what would it be?
Probably to start standing up for myself sooner and rather than as a result of the bad experiences. To, I mean, it doesn't matter if you go and see a phlebotomist and you look like a bitch for that one time you see that one person and they never take your blood again, but at least you didn't end up with a punctured vein and a swollen hand. And I think you said earlier about being kind to yourself. I probably would tell her to be kind to herself, but I don't think she'd listen to me.
And what do you think your younger self would tell you as advice now?
I think it's your experiences that really make you as a person. And to be honest, I wouldn't, as the person I was, even with it, well, I still had the same pain and everything else. I wouldn't, you just don't know until you've been through that situation and the way it changes you. And I mean, if it happened again, even with that information, I mean, I think there'd still be other problems that would arise as part of it anyway. So you're better to just stay your course, do you, stay true to yourself, and just be strong. Be strong for yourself if you can't be kind to yourself.
Oh, thank you so much, Natalie. Thank you so much for joining us today. You've been so generous with your story, and I think it will help a lot of people with EDS, without EDS.
Yeah.
It's a very powerful message. Thank you.
I hope so. If me being open about it makes one other person feel like they can be open with it, not necessarily publicly, but at least with their friends and their family, then, I mean, it's not something you should be ashamed of, really, your medical health. I mean, like you can't be ashamed of your mental health or anything out of that aspect of yourself. You just be open. It lets people know what you're going through.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. If someone you know could find this episode helpful, then please do share. You can check out all the other episodes on our website, freshheartproject.com. If you want to keep up to date, you can follow Fresh Heart Project on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can subscribe to our podcast, available on all popular podcast platforms. You can also subscribe to our YouTube channel. Don't forget to hit the bell for notifications on all new videos. The content of this episode is not a substitute for medical advice from your healthcare professional. Until next time, take care of each other and be kind to yourself.